Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for January 10, 2008. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We got a little aesthetics thrown in tonight, too. In a few minutes, we'll be listening to an interview I recorded earlier today with Tariq Ali, the London-based writer and political analyst, about goings-on in his ancestral homeland, Pakistan. Why Bhutto was assassinated, the forces at play in that country, the role of Washington in producing the disorder that is contemporary Pakistan, etc. Tariq Ali in about 5 or 6 minutes. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll have two people involved in the production of something called, an Atlas of Radical Cartography, which has been published by the Journal of Aesthetics and Protest. It's a little boxed set consisting of a book of texts and 10 maps, which look at the world of energy, water, garbage, power, and many other things. So we'll have the one of the editors of that atlas, Lisa Mogul, and Trevor Paglen, who is a contributor of one of the maps in there. His map is about the CIA's so-called extraordinary rendition flights, where they take people who are being held in the eternal global war on terror and are ferried all over the world to be tortured to produce some sort of information that they might find useful. A great offense to notions of justice and fairness in this world. Before we get to all that, just some observations on the political and economic news. First, some comments on the New Hampshire primary. I was just looking at some exit polls earlier today from that and discovered that Hillary Clinton won by quite a wide margin the votes of those with less than high school education or less, and that Obama won by a considerable margin those with postgraduate education. She won people coming from households with incomes below $50,000. He won households above $50,000. It does seem that this whole discourse of being post-partisan and even post-racial appeals much more to upscale voters than it does to middle-income and down to lower-income voters. It also seems that it appeals more to independents and wavering Republicans than it does to the Democratic base. What this means for the general election is another story, but it does suggest, as Karl Rove put it in a piece in the Wall Street Journal today, that Hillary has the beer-drinking portion of the Democratic Party and Obama has the wine-drinking portion, and there are more beer drinkers in the Democratic Party. So that suggests that in the coming primaries, in most states they're not open to voters who are not registered Democrats, she may well do considerably better than some of the polls have suggested, at least were suggesting until her surprise victory the other night. Also, strangely, Hillary's voters seem to want to get out of Iraq faster than do Obama's voters, even though he's pledged to do that, and she wavers all over the place on that question. So how people vote and what the candidates say don't often map on each other very elegantly, do they? And then to the economic news. Last Friday brought the release of the U.S. employment report for December, and it was a stinker. About the only thing that kept it from being a full-blown sign of recession was the absence of a negative sign in the headline payroll number. That number, though, is barely positive, showing a gain of just 18,000 jobs last month, a number that is statistically speaking indistinguishable from zero. And that's about 1/15 the total number you'd see in a normal month. In this case, normal, which is always a challenging concept, means the average over the last 50 years or so. Below the surface of that number, which is probably the single economic indicator that Wall Street pays the most attention to, things looked even worse. Some highlights of that badness. The headline gain of 18,000 jobs was very narrowly distributed, with a number of important sectors posting losses. All the jobs gained and then some came from the government, mostly state and local government. Federal employment has been flat for years and is now at the lowest share of total employment since the monthly figures began in 1939. The private sector lost 13,000 jobs in December, with good productions off 75,000. Two-thirds of those losses in goods were in construction, with all sub-sectors, not just residential construction, off on the month. Manufacturing is off by 31,000, continuing a long decline in that sector. Private services added 62,000, but even there, important sector has had minus signs. Retail was off a sharp 24,000. Information, which consists of publishing as well as electronic information, off 13,000. Finance off 4,000. Temp employment, which is often a forecaster of future employment trends, was unchanged. About the only significant private sector strength was in, as it has been for quite a while, healthcare, up 28,000, and bars and restaurants, up 27,000. Those two sectors have accounted for just over half of the total job gain over the last year. Apparently, our new economic model is eat, drink, and check into the hospital. Year-to-year job growth is just now 1% a year, well under the long-term average, and pretty close to what you usually see when the economy is about to tip into recession. A side note, last month the average hourly wage in private services, $17.42, surpassed that in manufacturing, $17.35, for the first time in over 30 years. The service wage exceeded manufacturing wages when the monthly figures began being reported in 1964, but began a long relative decline that maxed out in the mid-1980s, with the service wage 14% below the manufacturing one. That gap then began to narrow consistently over the last couple of decades and was finally closed last month. An important reason for this is the disappearance of a lot of high-wage manufacturing jobs, which has dragged down the average. In any case, the cliched image of manufacturing jobs as high-paying and service jobs as low-paying now has to be retired. The jobs and earnings stats I've just been quoting come from the Bureau of Labor Statistics survey of about 300,000 employers. They also do a simultaneous survey of about 60,000 households, the most famous product of which is the unemployment rate. That rate rose sharply in December, up 0.3 points, from 4.7% to 5.0%. Rates of that rises of that magnitude are quite rare. They're mostly found in recessions or just before them. And more than half the rise in unemployment came from permanent job losers, as opposed to people who are just on temporary layoff and expect to be called back. Many of these numbers are quite preliminary and are likely to be revised, perhaps significantly, in the coming months. Oh, and let me say this. From time to time, I hear from people who want me to say that these numbers are phony, more like lies cooked up by the Bush, administration. They're not. I follow this stuff very closely and talk frequently to the people who compile them. They do the best job anyone can. It's not easy coming up with accurate monthly estimates in an economy with over 130 million jobs. But regardless of where these final numbers shake out after all the revisions, and it's quite possible that the headline number could end up negative after the final changes come in, it's looking more and more like the U.S. economy is heading down. How far and how fast are open questions. The downturn will almost certainly raise the importance of the economy as an issue in this year's election. The Republicans will almost certainly offer more tax cuts, though we can't really afford them, as a solution. And the Democrats will offer, well, I don't know what they're going to offer. In the old days, the Dems would have talked about public works and job creation programs. New Democrats don't talk like that. How they do talk against the background of a weakening economy will be interesting to watch in the coming months. All right, let's take a little musical break. And that, an excerpt from Brahms' Intermezzo for Piano, Opus 117, number 1, performed by Julius Katchen. And Well, Pakistan has been exploding. It was in turmoil before the return of Benazir Bhutto, and has been in even more turmoil since her assassination a couple of weeks ago. I've been trying to connect with Tariq Ali, who is originally from Pakistan, and of course he's been living in London for a long, long time. But he's certainly very, very familiar with politics and the social structures of Pakistan. And I've been trying to connect with him for several weeks to do an interview about what's going on there, and finally succeeded this morning. So here in an interview recorded earlier this morning is Tariq Ali. Welcome, Tariq. Let's start out with a step back from the moment of the assassination to how Benazir Bhutto came to come back to Pakistan. You used the metaphor of an arranged marriage. Could you develop that metaphor for us?
Well, I mean, it was an arranged marriage, and the marriage brokers were John Negroponte in the State Department, obviously back from the top, and Gordon Brown, his fawning deputy in the British Prime Minister's residence. They pushed it through. Still slightly unclear as why they were so desperate, but they thought that by sending her back to Pakistan and forcing through this arranged marriage with Musharraf, they could then create a new situation, a new political bloc in the country, which would make it easier to fight the war in Afghanistan and deal with the jihadis on Pakistan's northwestern frontier. They believed this partially because she told them she could do it. And no one ever thought of asking her, well, why didn't you do it when you were in power? Because, in fact, what you did then was the exact opposite. You sent the Taliban into Afghanistan despite the anger of the then Afghan government, and backed by the Pakistani military, you put them into power. So how the hell are you going to deal with all this now? In any event, that's what happened. So they sent her back and promised her that her safety was assured. And, you know, we know with what results.
What drove Washington in this case? Was it ignorance, arrogance, short-term necessity? Do they just not know what's going on in Pakistan?
You know, Doug, I honestly think that short-termism has become such a disease now in American policymaking that they said, well, we've tried other things. They're not working. Let's give this one a quick try. And if it doesn't work, we'll think of something else. And that something else, of course, could only be another general from within the Pakistan Army. And last week I was looking at the New York Times, and I was in New York, and there it was. America sees new hope in General Kiani, the new leader of the army. So, you know, if Musharraf can't do it, they'll dump him and move on to another general. So the only possible thing they might have hoped with Benazir is that she would just carry out their instructions very loyally, which is what she'd promised to do, whereas they don't trust Musharraf 100%, though he has been pretty loyal. And it's backfired sensationally. I mean, with her assassination, the United States State Department didn't know what to do. But what astonishes me is, A, why they didn't foresee it when some of us could, and secondly, after the big attempt to blow her up the day she arrived, why they didn't tell her, look, no more big public rallies, just cool it. Given that the elections are going to be rigged anyway, we'll deal with Musharraf and make sure that you have a certain percentage of the seats. Don't you put yourself in danger. But they didn't do that. So she went on thinking she could take Musharraf on, and then the inevitable happened.
What's your best guess on who killed her?
Well, you know, it's very difficult to say. You remember this old Japanese classic movie, Rashomon, where someone is killed and three people come, and each has a convincing tale of how the murder could have taken place. And it's the same in Pakistan. There are three views doing the rounds at the moment. One is that, you know, this is the mainstream government view taken up by the Western media, that she was killed by jihadi terrorists, and of course headlines in the tabloid press everywhere, Al-Qaeda killed Benazir. There's absolutely no evidence of this so far, and people close to her are saying that it was not the jihadis. Well, that leaves we know who. The government in Pakistan, either Musharraf or people very close to him. And that is where most people in the country are pointing the finger, saying that it's the politicians Musharraf associated with who were fearful that if he did the deal pushed by the United States, they would lose out, and why not get rid of her? And certainly the police chief in Islamabad, responsible for her security, was an appointment of these crony politicians. So a lot of people believe it's that. And then there is a third, slightly outrageous view during the rounds that maybe her husband killed her because he wanted all the money for himself. But there is absolutely no proof for this, and it's just a sort of angry rumor. I say angry because people are not pleased that she appointed him the leader of the party.
You knew her fairly well. She had a pretty remarkable political evolution. So could you give us the history of Benazir Bhutto?
Well, you know, I knew her when she was very young. I knew her when she was not keen on politics at all. I remember her saying to me when she was still a student, and I had gone to speak at the university and we had dinner afterwards, and she said, you know, I'm not the least bit interested in politics, and my father is trying to push me towards having a political career. So I said, resist him. And she said, not easy to do, you know, he's very strong-willed. And I said, yes, but you can still resist him. And I said, what do you want to do ideally? And she said, I'd like to be a diplomat, work for the Foreign Office. I said, seems very reasonable to me. But then history intervened, and her father was toppled by a military coup in 1977 and judicially assassinated by the dictator Zia-ul-Haq in April 79, with the U.S. greenlighting the execution behind the scenes. This then forced her into politics. She said that to me a number of times, that had he not died, she might well not have done what her father wanted. And she then campaigned against the dictatorship, attacked the dictator, was in and out of prison. She and her mother were physically attacked by the cops attending a big event in Lahore. Both of them became very ill and spent long stretches in prison. And then she came, she was allowed out on medical business to have her eye tended to. Her eye had got very bad in prison. And, you know, it was very touching, these two women in Pakistan, run by a military dictator, trying to transform the country into not just a military, but a religious dictatorship, because that's when all these jihadi groups were brought into being by the state. And Benazir was extremely courageous, and we were close when she came to London in exile and used to meet regularly and discuss campaigns to take on the generals. And finally, when the time was right, she went back. And I told her, because I'd been talking to people in Pakistan, that there will be at least 1 million people to greet you when you arrive in Lahore. And she said, how can you be so sure? I said, I have contacts. People are talking. They're fed up with the dictatorship. And then she said, well, you better write my speech then, because I'm not 100% sure what to say. So I sat down and wrote her speech and then rehearsed it, because her command of Pakistan's native languages was not as strong as it should be. And but it's a funny thing is, I was, you know, writing and working on her speech, sort of refining it, because this was going to be a make-or-break speech. And one day she rang me up and said, you know, I had a dream last night. So I said, tell me. And she said, well, I dreamt I arrive, and as you say, there are 1 million people, and finally I arrive at the podium to make a speech, and I look in my handbag to bring it out, and my handbag is empty. So I said, don't worry, Ireland. But that very day I took the speech round and gave it to her. And then for a week we rehearsed it, and then she went off and did well. And, you know, about a year and a half later, she was prime minister of the country. She was elected.
But then as time moved on and she went in and out of office, she made accommodations with American power and got rather rich, didn't she?
Well, this is her tragedy. you know, she had pledged massive social reforms, which had been the platform of the Old People's Party. She had pledged an independent foreign policy. But when she finally got to power, she told me, we met soon after she became prime minister, and she said, I am completely encircled by the army and by this creepy ex-civil servant as president, and my hands are tied, I can't do anything. And I said, even if you can't do anything at this moment, you should tell the people who elected you why you're not doing anything. And it doesn't matter if it annoys them. You just annoys the powers that be. Tell people this is what I want to do, but I'm not being allowed to do it. She didn't do that either. And basically her first administration, right from the beginning, was a lame duck administration, not being able to do too much, making a few cosmetic changes. And then she was toppled. The governor, the president dismissed the government, there were new elections, and her rivals came. Anyway, she came to power the second time. This time, she basically decided that the only thing to do is to make sure that my sort of supporters and I aren't left out of the money-making race. She appointed her husband, Asif Zardari, Minister for Investment. And together, the pair of them amassed $1.5 billion in investments all over the world. Quite shocking, actually. And she did it quite openly. And people would say to her, not she wouldn't admit that it was corruption, but in private, when people would say, you know, it's going too far, she would say, people do it all over the world. That's what politics is about now. So why shouldn't I do it? I mean, not entirely wrong, this assessment, Doug, but very cynical. And, you know, to do it in a country where many villages don't have running water, there's no electricity still, there are no sewage facilities in parts of the country, their social infrastructure is virtually non-existent, medical health doesn't exist for the poor. It's bad. And this then did discredit her. So the next time when she was toppled, it was by a coup carried out by the guy she'd appointed president himself, and he said that the corruption had just gone too far. And then she lost the next election to her opponent, because people didn't come out to vote for her. She said the election was rigged, but in fact it wasn't. It's just that the bulk of her supporters, who were the poor of the country, didn't bother to come out and vote because they felt they had no stake in the system at all.
I'm speaking with Tariq Ali, the London-based writer and political analyst. Dictatorship and political assassination seems a very large part of Pakistani history. Is there no stable power structure? Is that why we see these outward signs of authoritarianism and instability?
Well, no, the problem is that every time political parties matured and were learning, building a base, trade unions were developing, a military coup would take place. Why? Because the United States Embassy, which was very strong in Pakistan, feared the emergence of parties and coalitions which would take Pakistan out of the security pacts. And this is why they encouraged the military to take over in 1958. And they were fearful then that Benazir's father, Bhutto, was developing nuclear weapons. So they encouraged General Zia to take power in a coup in 1977. And then Zia did develop nuclear weapons. So I think history of Pakistan, tormented though it is very much linked to the needs of the United States, because this is a country which decided a few years after it became independent that it couldn't exist on its own, it wouldn't do a deal with India, which would have made sense, and it looked for a replacement for the British Empire and found it in Washington. So Washington has been very centrally involved in running this country for many, many years. And, you know, if you look at the State Department documents published, the informality with which Henry Kissinger talks to Pakistan's leaders over the years is quite astonishing. It's not surprising in one level, but actually seeing the conversations is very revealing.
What is the economic structure of Pakistan like? Is there any kind of developed industry? Is there anything like what we're seeing that going on next door in India with the development of industry and services?
Well, there is. There are development of industry and some services, but nothing to compare with India. You see, the big difference with India is that over 15 years after independence, the Nehru government in India created a social infrastructure largely by having mega state intervention in creating industries, in some cases hanging on to them, in imposing import controls so that Indian industries developed, in providing the country with a proper education system, not great, but certainly a system. And within sort of 20 years of independence, India had the largest pool of postgraduates in the world. This was a sort of reserve pool of very highly skilled and educated manpower. And that is what explains what is happening in India today. Pakistan never even aspired to reach that stage. It's a country which is run by an incredibly callous and sick elite, which basically makes money. The other thing that happened in India is that the new government pushed through mega land reforms, taking power away from the landed gentry and the landlord class, who'd been, you know, one of the main bases of British rule for the previous 150 years. And in Pakistan, all attempts at land reform failed. To this day, you have very, very large land holdings, which have actually, you know, retarded the economic development of the country.
So what next for Pakistan now?
Well, what next for Pakistan now is an open question, Doug, because you have next door a big war going on with NATO countries involved and the U.S. involved in Afghanistan. And it is difficult to work out what the war aims are. I mean, if they're going to wait till Osama dies, well, okay, but so what? I mean, he'll die one day if he is still alive. And then what? I mean, what do you want to do? What does the West want to do with Afghanistan? They've implanted a government there which is totally and completely corrupt, which doesn't service the needs of its people at all, which is Karzai and his cronies getting rich. Karzai's brother is one of the largest arms and drug smugglers in the country, and the regime is totally discredited. What this has meant is a big rise of the Taliban, or people calling themselves that anyway, which is now fighting the NATO occupation. And surprise, surprise, the United States and Britain are negotiating behind the scenes with the Taliban to actually stop the fighting and join Karzai in a coalition government. And the Taliban are saying, well, we might do that, but we're not going to do it while there are foreign troops on our land. But you see, if there are no foreign troops there, then there won't be a coalition, because no one will want to even talk to Karzai. So it's a mess, and this mess creeps into Pakistan because the borders are virtually porous, because you have Pashtuns living on both sides of the borders, speaking the same language, having the same culture, and it's very difficult for any Pakistani government, however strong-willed, to close these borders down. You know, I mean, they're thousands of miles in mountainous territories. You can't build a wall like the Israelis have done. So it can't be done, in my opinion. It's virtually impossible. So instead, what happens is that the army has clashes with militants on the frontier. They kill them. This is creating havoc inside the Pakistan army, because many ordinary soldiers, who are not very literate, are saying, we don't want to kill other Muslims. Why are we in this war in the first place? Why are we doing the Americans' bidding? So that's the scale of the problem. And who can sort it out is an open question. But I think the future of Pakistan at the moment is very closely tied to what happens in Afghanistan.
And then finally, what about Western anxieties over the Islamic bomb?
Look, this for me is a complete joke. It's not serious. You know, I get really irritated when I read in the Western media that there's a danger of a jihadi finger on the nuclear trigger. You know, what if someone said there's a big danger of nutty born-again Christian fundamentalists in the United States capturing the U.S. nuclear facility? People would burst out laughing, I hope. In Pakistan, you have the nuclear facility is the most secure facility in the country. There is a nuclear code. This code is only known to four top people, mainly generals. No one can crack it, and the code is regularly changed. And the Pakistan army is 500,000 strong. So the notion that a group of jihadis could capture the nuclear facility, steal the missiles and bombs, and go and bomb Israel or whatever they fantasize about, is a pure, it's a total joke. It's not going to happen like that. There is no danger of a jihadi takeover in Pakistan unless the Pakistani military wants them to take over, in which case it's the military that's the problem.
And that was the voice of Tariq Ali, who is a London-based writer and political analyst, made films, written novels, and is now working on a book which will be published in the spring by Simon & Schuster on what's been going on in Pakistan. So you will be able to hear much more of his analysis that way. And also, he's got a piece in the London Review of Books, which is featured on the LRB website, lrb.co.uk, if you want to read more about his analysis of Bhutto and Pakistan. Okay, let's take a break for station ID.
Only two things scare me, and one is nuclear war.
What's the other?
Excuse me?
What's the other thing that scares you?
Hi, this is Jamie.
Hi, this is Sarah from Brand Van 3000, and you're listening to
WBAI 99.5 FM.
New York.
And this is WBAI in New York, not only at 99.5 in your FM dial, but on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. And let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about atlases. And that a bit of Wires map ref 41N93W, which I, after listening to this song for close to 30 years, I only today discovered that is in a field in Melrose, Iowa. That from Wires, what album was that from? I believe that was from 154. Anyway, that's from late 70s, early 80s, and it's kind of a cheesy material to bring to begin a discussion of maps and an atlas of radical cartography, to be precise. And we have one of the contributors and the editor, one of the editors of this project in the studio here with us. The editor is Lizzie Mogul, and the contributor is Trevor. I'm sorry. Excuse my poor preparation. Trevor Paglen, welcome to both of you. I'm very embarrassed and apologize for having screwed that up. So welcome to Behind the News. What is an atlas of radical cartography?
Well, I think the best way to start is to say that it's an atlas and not the atlas, because at the moment, or actually for many decades now, there's been this kind of building movement of cultural producers and activists and collectives and others using maps for their own purposes. And So this is a collection of 10 mapping projects and 10 related essays from this, you know, enormous collection of people using maps to talk about social issues.
Now you it's a collection of 10 maps and a book of essays in a very attractive box set, and published by the Journal of Aesthetics and Protest, which is actually a journal I was attacked in once. Which makes me feel good, but in a friendly way, I should say. You say in the essay that, or one of the essays, that mapping and is frequently a tool of domination. It's, you know, the sense that history is written by the victors, maps are made by the rulers, I guess. And also in the sense that geography traces its origins to imperial management. So what is it? Talk a bit about that kind of the use of the traditional use of mapping and domination and your attempt to turn that around.
Sure. Well, maps are definitely a tool of power and traditionally have been a tool of the state, a tool of the military, and of commerce, I guess you could say. And but, you know, like any sort of tool, I suppose it can be used by any number of people. And now that, in a sense, I think mapping is becoming more accessible now because certain technologies are becoming more accessible and certain ways of thinking about the world are more common. If you just think about something like the proliferation of Google Earth and this, the sort of like I guess the thinking about the God's eye view is now almost commonplace for everybody. So thinking about space in a particular way is becoming much more ubiquitous. So I guess one of the essayists, Jai Sen, talks about mapping as a question of power over or power to, and so using a map as a way of gaining power for yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting. In his piece, he talks about having bought a bag of peanuts and noticed a map on them, which the map expressing some sort of elite attempt to redesign someone's neighborhood. So could you just describe what that project was?
Jason was a radical planner working in Calcutta in the 70s through the 90s and formed a group called Unayan, which was a group of architects and planners who were working with what they call the unintended, so people who were unmapped with refugees or basically the working poor of Calcutta, who were living in unintentional communities along the margins of the city. And he happened to buy a bag of peanuts from a vendor and see a map printed on it, which was basically an advertisement for some sort of huge city project to put a road through a certain area, which happened to be where a couple of million of people were living unofficially. So through the work of Unayan, they basically mapped these communities and made them official, which in India at the time was very important to gain kind of official recognition and get things like water and sewers and postal delivery and identity cards and things like that. So through mapping, you gain identity.
And so that's one of the 10 maps in the box set.
Yes.
Give us an idea of what else is in there.
Well, you've got a real range of things in terms of stylistically and in terms of issues and methods of making maps. So you have, for example, a map by the artist Pedro Lash, which is a pretty accurate geographic rendering of the American continents. And emblazoned on it, it says Latino, Latina America. So sort of claiming the Americas for as a sort of Latino continent.
But with no borders on it.
With no borders, exactly. Yeah. You have a hand-drawn diagram that sort of looks like a high school textbook diagram by Jane Song, which is a diagram of the human impact on the water system in Los Angeles. You've got a very detailed, full-color kind of thought diagram by Ashley Hunt, which is about the kind of procedures of globalization and its impact on bodies. You have a sort of rearranged associative world map, which is my contribution to the book, which is kind of a circular narrative about globalization. You have Trevor Paglin, who's here, working with the designer John Emerson, with a more kind of like an airport the kind of like a flight map that you'd see in an airport magazine, an airplane magazine, but about the flight paths of CIA planes who are carrying out extraordinary renditions. So there's a real range.
Well, that is the voice of Lizzie Mogul, who is the one of the editors of an atlas of radical cartography. And speaking of one of the contributors who is here, Trevor Paglen, who did the map of, collaborated on the map of extraordinary rendition. How did you put that? Where'd you get the data? How'd you put that together?
Well, it started several years ago. I wrote a book actually called Torture Taxi that came out last year about the rendition program. And over the course of doing that research, I was assembling a huge amount of flight data. I mean, part of the research project for the book was to identify CIA front companies, charter companies that were somehow involved in this rendition program. And because they turned out to be civilian planes, you could actually get the flight data from the Federal Aviation Administration. There were public records. You could also get them from Eurocontrol in Europe. It's just one of these little ironies. But so in order to do the research for that book, I assembled a database, really, of all these flight plans, and I was drawing maps for myself to try to understand some of the routes that they were using and that sort of thing. I think at some point simultaneously.
How did you figure out in the first place that these were the CIA flights?
Oh, that's quite a long story, but it was a plane would show up at an airport in Palma, Mallorca on the day that someone said that they were kidnapped or that sort of thing. And then you'd look at who owned the plane, who financed it, and you'd start to uncover these bizarre paper trails that made no sense and were really quite sloppy work, to tell you the truth, if you were trying to hide a covert program.
But that's interesting because, at one point it would have taken, years of declassified material or something like the Church Commission to reveal all this stuff. You're doing it not exactly in real time, but pretty close to it.
With a 5-minute delay.
Yeah.
So, I'm able to get
they not as competent as they used to be?
Well, I think it's just a product, really, of the kind of information age. There's a lot more information out there. If you can find it, you can access it very, very quickly. I mean, there's a contradiction which is built into the CIA, which is the fact that it's a civilian agency. It's not the military. And so they have all these civilian front companies and that sort of thing that they use. And the ironic thing about it is even if you set up a front company, you have to file all the same paperwork than any other company has to file. Those are public records.
And so tell us about these flight paths. I mean, they extend even within the U.S. borders. They're not just things that are going on in shadowy locations abroad, right?
Absolutely. So I think the point of the map ended up being for me is, like Lizzie said, it looks like an in-flight magazine that you might find if you're flying to California or something like that. But instead of seeing, Chicago, New York, San Francisco, you'll find places like North Carolina, Washington, Dulles, Shannon, Ireland, Rabat, Morocco, Djibouti, Kabul, Afghanistan, Constanta, Romania. So you kind of get a map that connects all of these places that you probably don't think about very much. And you can, by looking at the map, I think you can kind of get a sense of what the geography, as it were, of the kind of darker sides of the war on terror might look like.
Yeah, so since a lot of these flights begin or pass through the United States, does that mean some of this stuff that's supposedly going on abroad is actually happening here as well?
Well, you have to keep in mind that not all of these flights are documented rendition flights. So we're just looking at the airplanes themselves. And so you'll see flights to, Las Vegas, for example, all the time. Now, in Nevada, there are huge paramilitary training ranges. So you can imagine that if you were involved in the CIA and you were flying to Nevada, you maybe are doing some training exercise there. Maybe you're meeting a contact in a casino there. Or if you see flights,
Or maybe you just like to gamble.
Maybe you just like to gamble, exactly.
Or like floor shows. Did you get any calls from folks in Langley who are not happy with your work, or do they ignore you?
I get people that are not happy from time to time. But actually, more interestingly, I've gotten fan mail from people in the CIA for doing some of this work.
Well, Aaron, I imagine that some of the more established guys are a little embarrassed by this stuff, aren't they?
Absolutely.
So did you get any help from them?
What?
You can either confirm or deny. Right, okay, let's not go there. That is the voice of Trevor Paglen, who is one of the contributors to this Atlas of Radical Cartography, published by the Journal of Aesthetics and Protest. And Lizzie Mogan, tell us about what is the Journal of Aesthetics and Protest?
It's a collective in Los Angeles that publishes a yearly journal. And they just started, basically just started a small press, and we're the second publication. They put out a book called Failure. It's about 6 months ago also. And it's basically, it's an artist collective.
And your map in this collection,
yes,
is a creative rendition of mm-hmm. San Francisco. Tell us about what mm-hmm. it looks like and what you're trying to say with it.
Sure. Well, it's a piece called From South to North, and it's a reference. That title is a reference to the south-oriented world map, which is actually one of the sort of original ways of picturing the world, where south was on top instead of north, or there are also other...
What we would think of as upside down.
Exactly. Or inverted. But if you're... Actually, you see a lot of these coming from Australia, actually, which is at the south end of the world, and they like to, you know, just... I mean, it's actually sort of the most basic form of radical cartography. You just take a world map and turn it upside down, it suggests an entire range of new political relationships and possibilities.
Now, when I visited Australia 5 or 6 years ago, some mm-hmm. people told me that the Australian imagination is obsessed with the notion that all the people from Asia are going to slide down onto Australia and contaminate them. So the conventional map doesn't affect the Australian imagination in a fundamental way.
Right.
But yeah, continue with San Francisco Bay.
So this map is part of a series which is taking the sites of the former sites of world's fairs in the United States and kind of using those as a jumping off point to free associate and talk about globalization. To sort of speak very broadly about it. So what you have is a kind of map mashup, which contains San Francisco and Oakland, Panama and the Panama Canal, Canada and the Northwest Passage, and a sort of trace of a satellite image of the mothballed fleet, which is a fleet of 99 or 98 naval ships, which are just basically in storage in the Suisun Bay. That's east of San Francisco. And so there's a that map is on one side, and then on the flip side is text, which is within the sort of country shapes that describes what each location has, sort of story about each location and what it has to do with the other. So, for example, the San Francisco World's Fair celebrated the opening of the Panama Canal. This was in 1915. The Panama Canal opened in 1914.
And as they say, the Panama Canal put San Francisco on the map as a port,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. And it sort of put the U.S. on the map as even more so as a world power, because it was an incredibly strategically important waterway for not only trade but also for sort of military strategy. It was very strategic in terms of the military. Now the Northwest Passage in Canada, which has been opening up because of global warming, is becoming a very much sought-after passage as well, which would shorten the distance, you know, in terms of trade. It would create another sort of Atlantic-Pacific waterway besides the Panama Canal. So that's a sort of place to watch, I guess. It's a territory that's very much contested and will be, you know, even more contested as the years go on. So, and then the Mothball Fleet, which is a sort of detritus of, you know, World War II, and I don't know actually how many wars are represented in those ships that are mothballed there. And so those sort of point to even another place. So a lot of those ships, some of them are sunk as artificial reefs, and some of them are taken to Bangladesh to be shipbroken, where there's absolutely no sort of, labor control whatsoever. And there's, you know, a lot of exploitation. So it's this kind of circular narrative of territory and displacement and that sort of thing.
I notice that one of the themes that comes up as you look through these things is that Americans tend to be a very isolated people in a lot of ways. You know, even though we come from all over the place, we're very provincial in our own way. And we're also, I think one of the essays points out, we feel ourselves very separated from nature. Mm-hmm. But in fact, we're deeply mixed up with that thing, too. So, I mean, is that part of your intention in doing these maps, of restoring these sense of connections that have either eroded or never been properly made in the first place?
I'm not sure if it's so specific to the U.S., although a lot of the contributors are American, and a lot of the maps sort of focus on the states. But I think one thing about maps is that they do help you see connections and relationships between things that maybe you didn't see before. So they create counter knowledges.
Yeah, I'm thinking of two things in particular. One is the water map, the process that leads to water coming out of a bathroom tap in Los Angeles is very complicated. Tell us about that that entry.
Sure. Well, Jane Song, who's an artist in L.A., has this great diagram that shows the sort of quote unquote natural source of all water in L.A., which is the mountains, but it's instantly processed by all sorts of municipals, mechanical and chemical systems. And then, goes through the city into households and commercial businesses and industrial uses and things like that. And along the way is affected by things like garbage and runoff from parking lots. Along the way, also, the water from the ground becomes bottled water, which is probably about as unnatural as you can get. And when we had the companion essay for the book was a roundtable discussion between a number of people who write about nature think about nature or legislate nature, for example. And the issue of bottled water came up quite a bit because it's, for example, the petroleum used to make the plastic bottle is quite, that's something that most people don't think about as well as what happens to the plastic bottles after you use them. So the whole idea of water is a natural thing, especially when it's in an urban environment, is kind of a fallacy.
Yeah, well, the bottled water people trade on purity to it, exactly. That sort of thing, even though there's great deals of waste involved in producing this stuff. And then the other map that interested me is I hadn't realized until a little while ago that my friend Heather Rogers had contribution. Heather did the book Gone Tomorrow about garbage, which came out a couple of years ago from the New Press. Interviewed Heather on that when the book came out. But there's a map on the flow of garbage in New York City. So tell us about garbage in the city.
Well, Heather's essay is great because she talks about the sort of the mob versus mob, how the sort of corporate mafia replaced the mafia in commercial waste hauling in New York City. And the map is by the Center for Urban Pedagogy, and it's made with students from City of School from a project that they ran in 2002, I think, called Garbage Problems. And it's basically a diagram of garbage stakeholders in New York City. So you have, at the top, you have the politicians and the elected officials. On the side, you have the commercial waste haulers. You have community activists, like people from Sustainable South Bronx, who are trying to kind of alleviate garbage problems in their neighborhood. And then at the bottom, you have the garbage consumers slash producers, which are the students and the cup staff, which are pictured in little icons in the shape of waste baskets. So to show that everybody, all of these people have a role in the production and the the production of garbage in the city.
And also reminded that, we all produce garbage. The big companies like Waste Management and Browning Ferris are the ones who channel it. And if you're poor and black, you're most likely to be living in a neighborhood that receives it. So it's
exactly. Unless the city's plan does go through to sort of evenly distribute the waste transportation throughout New York City, which I think is genius.
The city has this plan on it.
Yes. And
our green mayor.
Our green city council speaker. People in wealthy neighborhoods are complaining, as you can imagine.
I can imagine. If you spend $1 million in a studio apartment, you don't want garbage transfer next door,
right,
do you? So we're almost out of time. So tell us how people can get a hold of this book. Is it in bookstores? Or is
It will be in bookstores starting this month. It's being distributed by DAP. But you can also buy it from us, from the website, which is www.an-atlas.com.
www.an-atlas.com.
Yes.
And that is the voice of Lizzie Mogul, who is one of the editors of An Atlas of Radical Cartography. And also earlier in this segment, you heard from Trevor Paglen, who's one of the contributors and author also of a book on, since you're here, you might as well plug your book.
Sure. My book came out last year called Torture Taxi, and I have a new book out called I Could Tell You, But Then You Would Have to Be Destroyed by Me, which is a book of emblems and badges from black military projects. And have a book coming out next year called Blank Spots on a Map, which is about disappeared places and military secrecy.
The occupational hazard of working this sort of area is it can make you a little crazy, can it?
Well.
The wilderness of mirrors, just as James Angleton, quoting Eliot, called it. All right. Well, again, we've been speaking with Lizzie Mogul and Trevor Paglen, and pick up a copy of their excellent Atlas of Radical Cartography. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening. And let's go out with this a little bit from von Sudenfed, which sounds like a German cold remedy, but in fact it is a collaboration of Mouse on Mars and Mark E. Smith from The Fall. Till next week. Bye.
Zu deiner neuen Rock. Pass doch gut zu deiner neuen Rock. Pass doch gut zu seiner neuen Rock. Pull over, pass doch gut zu deiner neuen Rock.